The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And what a cool location. I am in the middle of Tasmania with Kate Hill at Kate Hill Winery. Kate, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
That's a pleasure, Matthew. Thanks for coming all the way to the Huon Valley in southern Tasmania to meet with us.
Actually, let's start there because I want to do your wine origin story and what life was like for you back in 2008 and how you got here. But for people listening, I was wondering if you'd explain a little bit what the Huon Valley is all about from a viticultural standpoint. What people that like wine that are getting into Tasmania, if they see that name on a bottle, what that kind of means.
Okay, so we're really the most southern region in Tasmania, so Australia's southernmost region. We therefore harvest our grapes pretty late. Often we'll pick our Syrah, for instance, in early to mid-May, and a lot of the Pinot in late April. Because of the late season and the long, slow ripening period, we have low yields. The vineyards tend to be smaller and tended more by hand. So really it's all about super high quality and doing all the things along the way to make sure that happens.
How long is the growing season here? Because talking to other winemakers, it's much, much longer than in a lot of classic old world regions or even in Ontario where I'm from.
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. But I can tell you that bud burst is usually late September. Mm-hmm. And then harvest is, for sparkling, anywhere from the beginning of March through to, as I said, mid-May for the Syrah. So I guess we could add up how many months that is.
So that's that's 7 or 8 months in total. That is a long period of time for the wine.
It's a lot
for
the grapes. That's right. It's a long time to be caring for your vines.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, as we're doing this, there's going to be a couple times we're going to be pausing. We're trying your 2022 Brut, and I see that a van has showed up. So it looks like, is there a tasting group coming? Is there people coming, or are they lost? I can't decide what's what.
Good question. I don't think we knew they were coming, but that's all right. They're welcome.
Yeah. So actually, let's just start with the sparkling Brut. What do I need to know about what's in the glass from this fella here?
This is our 2022 vintage Brut. It is made from Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. It's had 3 years on yeast lees, all in the traditional method. In the Huon Valley, we get lots of natural acidity and softness of the fruit thanks to that slow ripening. So we've got beautiful intensity of fruit, fresh acid coupled with all of that nice creaminess from the thyme on lees.
All right, so that's the Brut. We'll get into, you guys have a Chardonnay, a Rosé. You also have three different Pinots and a Shiraz. So we'll get back into the wine for a second. But I want to hear a little bit about your origin story. What led you to where you are now? What led you to Kate Hill Winery?
Okay, so led me to Kate Hill Winery more than what led me to winemaking.
We'll start with winemaking.
Okay, could be a very long podcast. So I grew up in a suburb of Melbourne where there were no vineyards or wineries. So when I left school, I wasn't really thinking of becoming a winemaker. I went to Melbourne Uni and studied science. I was always interested in being in the country and plants. So I majored in biochemistry and botany because I love plants. And when we were growing up, my grandparents had a farm in the Riverina, which is it's in New South Wales, but backs onto the Victorian border where there's forest and river and stuff. And I always loved being in the country and the agriculture was always interesting. Slowly, I guess, when you've got those interests, I didn't know that I was going to head here, but I then went travelling overseas for a year and a half and I came back, did a graduate diploma in the arts faculty at Monash Uni studying tourism marketing, and which probably wasn't very me, but I ended up getting a job at a place called the Victorian Wineries Tourism Council in Melbourne, and they were funded by Tourism Victoria, and so it was just myself and my boss. And it was our job to encourage visitation to Victoria's wineries. So that was back in about 1994, 95. That was where the world of wine started presenting itself to me. So I was meeting winemakers and we had to go out to the region sometimes, and then I started doing wine appreciation courses down the road after work to learn more. And yeah, one thing led to another, and then I got a part-time job on the weekends at a winery out in the Yarra Valley. Then I was like, well, how can I learn more about wine? And I found this course in Adelaide called, anyway, I applied for that course, but I was talking to the head of the department and he said, Kate, this course really is if you want to become a winemaker. And I was like, oh, right. Gee, well, that's not me then. So, but then I was telling a friend about it one day and she said, oh my gosh, that would be perfect for you. Anyway, something clicked over in my brain and I thought, oh, well, maybe I could be a winemaker. So I went off to Adelaide and studied oenology as a postgraduate student. Then haven't really looked back. So I worked in the Napa Valley at Joseph Phelps Vineyards. Mm. Then over to down, actually, worked at Viña Tarapacá in the Maipo Valley of Chile. Do you know it?
I mean, I know obviously of the valley and the wines there, yep. But I haven't heard of that producer.
And then I worked at Maison Charpentier à Tain, l'Hermitage. Did a vintage there and then came back to Australia, and I was in WA with, at the time it was BRL Hardy, looking after their fruit across the state, processing it, and then came back to Victoria, did a vintage based at Coldstream Hills in the Yarra, and then I got a permanent job with Orlando Wyndham, which they're not called Orlando Wyndham anymore, but in Griffith in the Riverina, where we made 30,000 tonnes of Jacobs Creek. So it's still about three times more than Tasmania's biggest crush.
Yeah.
Oh, just in one winery. And I was there for about 4 years, and that's quite a hot, high-yielding, big-producing region, you know, lower end of the quality.
Yeah, it's your mainstream just high volume wineries that are actually important for any country for getting people into wine who are just learning about wine.
Yeah, so I was there for 4 years and it actually was a really great learning ground, you know, because we're a big company and had other wineries. I knew I didn't really want to stay there forever, and at that point I think I was in my early 30s and I thought, well, time to be doing what I'd really love to be doing. So I had a good hard think about what that was, and I thought, well, I'd just really love to be making beautiful sparkling wine. And to do that, I need a cool climate. I knew I didn't want to leave Australia. So Tasmania it was. The arrows were pointing to Tasmania.
Yeah, it's funny. By the way, you know, I thought you did a great job just making that so concise. But you can so see how you were going to get there. I mean, just having the interest in plants and biology or farming or being outside, and then that would easily lead you to where you are now. And also, what three completely different areas, like Joseph Phelps, and then in Chile, and then Charpentier, and then coming back at Jacobs Creek. The great thing is all those years, you must have been learning all of these different skills and tricks of the trade from completely different perspectives.
Yeah, I do. I look back and I think, I wonder what I did learn. But I'm just sure there's, in a winery, you know, there's always so much going on and so many people with a lot of experience that you do, yeah, I'm sure pick up a lot, soak up a lot along the way. And yeah.
Which one should we try next? And by the way, it's funny, you were saying what's interesting, there was more of a sense of the sweetness on the sparkling, but that's because, as you said, it was near the end of the bottle.
Yeah.
But even then, it wasn't like sweetness in a bad way. It was this rich and full-bodied and almost a sweet orange thing coming out. So, I mean, really enjoyed the sparkling. But what do you think we should try next? What do you think is a great expression?
Well, we haven't got it on the tasting because the wine was bottled recently and I wasn't happy that I thought it just needed a few weeks to rest. It's starting to evolve a bit, but we're quite well known for Riesling. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why, but maybe we should try that since that's one of our main varieties. Okay.
All right, we'll take a quick pause and then we'll come back with the Riesling.
Sure.
This is a really interesting Riesling, and I mean interesting in a good way. You know, sometimes someone says the word interesting and that's code for not that good, but there's like almost like a meaty savory note on the Riesling, which was my sort of my first impression. What is a vintage, and is this Riesling close to where we're sitting here?
This is the 2025 vintage, so it's quite fresh and young. The fruit actually comes from the Upper Derwent Valley, which is about an hour's drive from here, a little bit further inland in Tasmania, southern Tasmania. We get the fruit from the same vines each year. So that's interesting. You thought it was quite savoury. The first thing it hit me was the beautiful aromatic lime. But you're right. You know, there is always a savoriness to the Rieslings down here.
Yeah, no, and we've been, you know, trying a bunch of them. I guess Riesling works just because you are cool climate. You know, it feels like it would make a lot of sense. So you've done all this training. You're now going to be making your own wine. You certainly are ready for it. I was wondering if you could take us to 2008, because that seemed to be right when all of this started to get established.
When I came down here, yeah, I did a vintage at Stefano Lubiana Wines when I'd left Griffith, and that was really fabulous. And I thought, gee, I really like it down here. But the industry back in 2006 was still very small. It still is small, but 20 years ago, it was really small. And there weren't that many jobs around, no sort of winemaking jobs that would really be quite of interest after having done so many, you know, being in so many amazing wineries. I thought, well, I'll just go and create some work for myself. So that's, I did a small business management course, got an ABN and started doing bits and pieces around the place. But I was offering my services to other vineyards or wine producers, thinking, well, maybe I can help them in some capacity. But to be honest, no one was particularly interested. Perhaps I wasn't very good at selling myself.
Really? I mean, considering just all your experience and traveling around and working big and small places, and yet people were hesitant?
Yeah, maybe. Or perhaps it's just the reality of small business and people don't have spare resources to take on someone else. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, if no one's particularly interested, maybe I can just go and do something for myself. So I started doing what nearly every winery I have worked in up to that point had done at least a portion of, and that is buy some fruit, use another winery to make the wine, and then bottle it and label it. So I bought some fruit, found a couple of vineyards. Back in 2008, it wasn't so hard to get hold of fruit. Then used a contract winery, oversaw the process, found a graphic designer a local one who also actually happened to be my friend. Kate Hill Wines was born.
And what was the first? Was it a sparkling? Was the first one you made?
We made a Riesling, a Pinot Noir, and a sparkling that year.
Do you have any of it left? Any of it squirreled away somewhere?
I do, actually. We pulled out some 08 Riesling the other day, and we had it on sale at the cellar door. Tim got to try it.
How was it? How was it pouring? How was it tasting? Tim said the 09 was even better.
Just all of those beautiful, complex age Riesling characters, you know, lots of nuts and honey and honeysuckle and still with a nice acid line.
Mm-hmm.
So that was looking really good. So when I say we, I guess I'm talking about my husband. So his career has been in the Air Force, but he's been on this journey along the way and he loves wine as well. So we entered two of the wines, the Riesling and the Pinot, in the Tasmanian Wine Show that year. So January 2009 it went in, and we won the Consumer Award. There was no trophy in this class for the Riesling, so the top wine. But and then the Pinot Noir won the Best Pinot Noir trophy. And then the Pinot Noir also won the trophy for the best wine of the show. So this new woman who'd just flown in from the mainland, who no one was interested in, came in and stole three of their trophies.
And you're sourcing the fruit from other places, mm-hmm. making the wine, first time doing it. How good did that feel for you? Like, just in terms of making you realize, yeah, I'm on the right path. Because earlier in the interview, you're like, oh, I don't need to be a winemaker. And you needed a friend of yours to sort of help push you. And now here you are winning all these awards. That must have felt great.
I did feel good. It felt really good. And it actually gave us the confidence to keep going and say, all right, well, that went well. Perhaps we'll do that again next year.
And then also, just from a pure business standpoint, wine, so much of it is about the word of mouth. And now it's like, oh, okay. Oh, Kate, they were the ones that won that competition. And at least it must have given you a little bit more credibility, because wine can be a hard thing to sell. It's emotional. It's people get nervous about what they're going to buy or not. But now you've got some, you know, you got some bona fides right off the hop.
Yeah, that's right. It did give us a bit of cred. Yep. Mm-hmm. So it was a good start.
And 2008. So at some point, you start your winery, you get pregnant, and you get married. What what time frame did all of this happen in? Because that seems like a very busy period for you.
Oh, it was really busy. And you know what's even worse? I just don't think it's slowed down. It hasn't stopped. If anyone wants to be busy, just plant a vineyard, start a winery, and open a cellar door.
And that was, yeah, we're talking now like 18 years ago. You probably did. You didn't sleep much those first couple of years, did you?
Probably not. You know, the time we really didn't sleep was when we planted the Shiraz here in 2016. Well, I didn't sleep. My husband was all for it because there were a few good reasons. And I was as well. But when those vines went in, I kept thinking, oh, my gosh, what have we done? Because we believe we are Australia's coolest Shiraz site. So we're really on the margins, especially this year, considering it's 3 or 4 years late. But we've actually produced some beautiful wine from the fruit here.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with the Shiraz. We were trying the one at Mewstone, and that was really good. So, okay, so for you, for the Shiraz, this must have been a passion project. Oh, you worked at Chapoutier.
I did.
That's okay. See, now it's okay. Now it's come sense, because it's, if you're feeling nervous about planting a grape in such a southern region where you're wondering, is the climate, is it going to be warm enough? Is it going to be able to ripen properly? Obviously, that's a varietal you love.
I do love it. And I always remember when I finished at wine school in Adelaide, I announced to everybody I was going to work in the Clare Valley in South Australia. And I've actually never worked in the Clare Valley. But the reason was it's a great region for Shiraz and for Riesling. And back then, they were my two favourite varieties. And yeah, I mean, we're now so well known for Riesling. I don't know why. Like, is there something we do that's special? I'm not sure. But we've got a really strong following and are well known for Riesling. And Shiraz is probably growing.
What do you think we should try next? And by the way, that is a great reason. Like, you're right. Like, the juicy lemon, like all those sort of classic stone fruit are there. But I still got just that little underpinning of this, like, savory, meaty note, which I thought was really cool. What do you suggest should we try next?
How about our Four Winds Chardonnay?
Love it. We'll try the Chardonnay. So we are now got the 24 FW Chardonnay. What does the FW stand for, by the way?
Four Winds. So this property where we're sitting today is known as Four Winds. It's been Four Winds right from day dot. And it's not too windy today, but it can come in from all different directions.
And that must help, obviously, with just less disease, getting less disease here. What would you say is the, and by the way, for the wine, you know, we were talking about it before, it's been open for a couple days. There may be a little bit of reductive notes on it, but it's still fresh. It's got that creamy middle. I mean, this is just like a classic, well-made, full-bodied Chardonnay, but with the restraint that you would want.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We really want that beautiful mineral, sort of soft acid, but assertive, just to give that nice line through the whole mm-hmm. wine and keep it fresh.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's absolutely there. What's the hardest thing in terms of what does weather present the biggest problems for you guys? Like in Ontario, we get frost or we get bad rain at the wrong times at the end of fall. But what is it here? What is the biggest challenge for wine growers?
A good question. So we get a bit of everything. But I would say, I mean, our biggest challenges to date have been extreme events such as bushfire, which has wiped us out, hail, which has wiped us out only once, thank goodness. So they've been the two most severe things. Everything else we can manage, but we do get quite a bit of wind. We get frost. We've got overhead sprinklers. I'm mm-hmm. not sure if you use them in Ontario.
Oh, yeah.
So in, you know, when we get into late September, once we've had bud burst, I always start feeling sick in the stomach about all the sleepless nights that lay ahead, like having a newborn baby, but we do it. So frost, but we can mitigate that. But, you know, there's always the chance that, you know, the pump won't turn on or something, you know, so I'd prefer that we didn't get frost. And apart from that, I guess every year it's something different. This year it's going to be making sure that we get the fruit ripe.
Right, because it's a cooler climate, so you're waiting and waiting before you pick.
Yeah, that's right. With the very wet, cold, windy spring, this whole season is about 3 or 4 weeks later than usual.
And yeah, it's funny, we've been hearing that from so many of the other winemakers. How scary was 2019 with the bonfires, or the bushfires, excuse me?
Yeah, it was pretty scary. Like at one point there was a little bit of, see that big hill over there? We could see the fire right at the top of the hill because it was all behind there. But we felt safe here. Like we didn't feel under threat from fire, but the smoke was terrible. this main highway down here was closed for about a month. So obviously there was no cellar door action because cellar door closed for about 6 or 8 weeks. And it was just terrible knowing that there were a whole lot of people evacuated just down at the evacuation centre.
And then 2 years later, the hailstorm, did it come out of nowhere? Was it something, were you warned about it, or were you just standing around and suddenly you had a plan for your vintage and then suddenly 2 minutes later you have to have a new plan?
Yeah, our vintage plan was shattered within an hour. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just came in. We didn't know it was coming. Mm-hmm. And we do get a bit of hail in this area, but the old timers, so the 80 plus farmers, 80 plus year old farmers, all said they'd never seen hail like it. So it was a pretty severe storm.
How much did you lose?
Pretty much almost everything, apart from about 1 tonne of Shiraz that we decided to pick. Yeah. So out of the 4 hectares we have under vine, there's only 1 hectare that we picked. That was the Shiraz, and it was very low yielding because there was hardly any fruit there.
Right. Yeah. God, that would just be so... You do all this work, and then a couple minutes of Mother Nature, and just everything changes.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, it was early in the season, so, you know, when everything's just growing and you're starting to flower. And it was really interesting. After that, because there are a few other growers just in this area who got hit as well, and the cherry and apple growers. And everyone's a little bit depressed. And it made me, for the whole season... And it made me realise that I actually think we've all got something in us, some genetic programming that makes us want to grow and produce. And if that gets interrupted, it's really quite disturbing. Well, yeah.
Because you have one plan, you have one way. And yeah, and also it's a very nurturing thing. I want to grow. I want to produce fruit and food or whatever, wine, because you want to help feed people.
I think now, it suddenly, is something a bit yeah. deeper than that. You know, yeah. Take away the financial devastation and the distress and, you know, all that stuff. I think there's something deeper as well inside us about that. That's right, growing and nurturing and producing.
You mentioned the old-timers and about how this was the worst hail. What's your relationship with the old-timers? Because, again, though you've now been around for 16 or so years, which in New World standards is a fairly long period of time in certain parts of the wine world, but how is the relationship you with the old heads?
Oh, yeah, that's good. I hope you're talking about them and not me. I'm not ready to be an old-timer, but...
You're far from it. You have several more decades.
So our neighbour, for instance, John Frankham, he's in his early 80s, I think. Sorry, John, if I've got it wrong. We got on well with him, but I guess the Huon Valley is a younger wine-growing area, so we don't really have old-time wine growers down here. I mean, Home Hill have Terry and Rosemary Bennett, who have been producing vines fruit for about 30 years. So they could be old timers. So, yeah, no, we have a good relationship. It's such a small valley. Then, you know, you've got the small community thing going on. We're all very supportive of each other.
Which makes sense because everyone's trying to raise everyone else up. So it's not competitive like in certain other parts of the world. Your Pinot program, and we can try them after the interview, but I see you've got three different ones, KH, Four Winds, and the Glen. What are sort of the differences in terms of style and where the grapes come from?
Okay, so the KH Pinot, I kind of think of it as our entry-level Pinot, even though it's still a complex, sophisticated Pinot. We actually get the fruit from other vineyards for that product. Mm-hmm. And then we've got the Four Winds, which comes from this vineyard here. The Pinot's on the other side of the dam. And then we've got the Glen, which is about a kilometre from here where our winery is. And there are some differences to this site. So the soil's different. It's a bit more sandy and gravelly. Up here, it's more of a mudstone, so it's a bit heavier. Down a bit lower, so I think gets more cold air drainage, so it tends to be a tiny bit later. The orientation is a tiny bit different. And the clones are pretty much the same. There's a few small differences, but I see the slightly different temperatures and the soil types as the main differences between the two.
What are you looking for? And again, this is generalization alert question, so there isn't one answer. But when you want to have a good glass of Tasmanian Pinot, what are you looking for? And I recognize if it's a heavier soil versus a sandy soil, there are going to be differences. But just because when I thought of Tasmania, I always thought of sparkling, Chardonnay, and Pinot. That was you know, just my limited knowledge of it from Canada. But what are you looking for?
That is a good question. So for me, a Pinot, perhaps depending on price point, it can be different things. So one thing that I really like to see in them, though, is freshness, that wine has been well looked after and kept fresh the whole way through its life and in bottle. And also displaying perhaps some typical Pinot characters, which are so, you know, perhaps a bit ethereal or in a lot of climates very hard to capture. So to make it a reasonable Pinot, I think it's got to be fresh and it needs, I mean, it can be aged but still fresh, if you know what I mean. But it's also got to have something that says this is Pinot Noir, you know, some true characters.
And then with your Shiraz, it's interesting because all the Shirazes we've tried in Tasmania taste the exact opposite of anything that we've tried in Barossa. Ah. In Australia, you know, just they're very, very sort of different styles. And I'm wondering how you would tell someone about if they're going to be trying Shiraz from here versus your Shirazes from, you know, from Barossa. What would you say would the main differences be?
Yeah, so that's easy to answer because we do talk about it a lot at the Cellar Door. such a versatile variety, you know. We've got people producing Shiraz up in Queensland all the way down to here. So we find that the wine, often the alcohol is a lot lower, like we'll often be at 12.5% to 13% alcohol, whereas the warmer areas of South Australia, for instance, might be 14-15%. We get a bit more spice and peppery notes, but I always find that it has this blueberry backbone. You know, there's still the fruit going on, but more savouriness and spice in the wine, and just a bit lighter. I do say that it's more like a medium-bodied red wine rather than a full-bodied red wine.
Right, yeah. So then last question for you. This might go in a couple different places. I know that you you took part recently in a mentorship program, the I Lead Tassie Wine Program. And I'm wondering just how that experience was for you and the importance of mentoring, especially probably mentoring women where there are fewer women in the wine industry than men.
I have been struggling a little bit for probably a decade or perhaps 5 years with trying to make a mental shift into actually being a bit more like the boss and letting go a bit, because, you know, when you start something from the very beginning, it's very hard to let go and, you know, let someone come into your winery who might have only been doing it for 3 or 4 years, but you've just done it for 20 years and that kind of stuff. So I think so this process of growing perhaps has been happening, but it's been slower than I've wanted it because, you know, if you want to grow your business, you've got to hurry up and get into that state of mind. So I have struggled a lot with that, but I actually feel that the I Lead program helped me take a bit more of a bounce, a bit more of a jump ahead and say, all right, let go a bit, bring these other people up. And so it's helped me a lot with that.
That must be hard though, because working in wine is one way so infuriating because you want to have control, but you don't, because hail comes and then all the control goes away. But at the very least, you know, and this is your business. It's your name is on the bottle. So that makes sense that you're going to pour every piece of emotion into when you're going to prune, when you're going to pick, how much oak you're going to use. That totally makes sense that can be hard to sort of start to give that up because it's your name on the bottle.
Yeah, and it's more than just your name on the bottle. It's kind of yours. And that's really why we're doing this, is because we love producing something that is beautiful and magnificent. And we only get one shot each year. So we want to get that right and make the best product we can. If someone makes the trip all the way to southern Tasmania and goes to the effort of coming to our cellar door, we want the wine to look beautiful.
And there was some windy roads on the mountains to get here as well. What do you hope for your winery? Say, let's see, it's 2026, early 2030s. I'll leave you with this one.
Well, I'd like it to be flourishing in lots of ways. Yeah, I guess I would like the quality to just keep improving. Really just to be making magnificent wine, really, that's what I would love it to be doing. I think we're already doing that, but there's magnificent and there's magnificent, isn't there? We just can take it, keep taking it to just beautiful, magnificent wine.
I can't wait to try the reds. And you need to know, when we were traveling around at Tupadol and Pressing Matters and Pooley, I said, oh yeah, I'm going to go interview Kate. And everyone lit up. I was like, oh, you're going to talk to Kate. You're going to love her. And just from all the research, everything I've done, it seems like you're not only on your way, but you're making incredible wines. You were an award-winning winemaker your first year doing this back in 2008. Appreciate the time and congratulations on all your success and wishing you nothing but future success down the road. And I'd recommend everyone come to Tasmania. It's a very different profile from a lot of parts of mainland Australia. And I don't mean that as a positive or a negative, just as a statement of fact. I think people should come here and try all the different wineries around. And I appreciate you doing the pod today.
Great. Thanks very much for coming to visit us and for being interested in us, Matthew.
Absolutely.
And thanks, Amy and Christy, for coming along too. Nice to meet you.
That's right. They are, as always, when I travel the world, Amy and Christy are always right next with me as well. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.